I'm Karen Garrison, and I'm an alcoholic.
And
it's through the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship that I've been sober since May 30th, 1982. And that doesn't make me a miracle. It makes Alcoholics Anonymous a miracle. And if you're new in this room tonight, I want to welcome you to God's magnificent Pacific group, the group that I'm very, very proud to be a member of, the group that I moved to Southern California for. And I hope that you stay. And I hope that you get a sponsor tonight. I hope that you get that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and that you get busy and do what everybody else is doing around here. And you're going to stay sober as I've stayed sober for 10 years. And people like me cannot stay sober, I can guarantee you. I want to thank Frank for the honor and privilege of speaking here tonight. You know, I love this program, you guys. I love this program more than anything in the whole world. And I make an awful lot of mistakes, and I do an awful lot of things wrong. But I'll tell you one thing, goddammit, that I love you. Make no mistake about that. I've been taught to do an awful lot of things before I ever opened my big mouth. And one thing is to talk to my sponsor. And if anybody in this room is wondering why I have a man for a sponsor, I have Clancy for my sponsor. It's because I didn't get sober in California. I got sober in a place called Lincoln, Nebraska, which is just a terrible place to get sober, if you want to know the truth. I wasn't doing well in Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska. I went through 19 sponsors at a rapid clip, and I'm certainly not proud of that as I stand up here tonight. And, you know, thank God for the old-timers in AA, because somebody loved me enough to get me to my current sponsor. And I got to tell you that my life has done nothing but totally, completely turn around as a result of it. And I talked to him today, as I do every single day of my life, and I told him tonight, I said, I'm really scared about giving this talk. And he said, well, why? He said, this is only the single most important moment of your life. Why would you be scared about it, you know? And I started thinking about that, and I'll never forget the first time I heard Clancy talk, and that was in Kearney, Nebraska, a number of years ago. And when they introduced Clancy that night and he got up to the podium, he fell off the stage backwards, you know? And I literally could not believe it. And I absolutely fell in love with this guy. And he got up to the podium, and he said, what he said was, a newcomer would have gotten hurt in a fall like that, you know. And I absolutely loved this man. And I knew that that was going to be my sponsor forever, I got to tell you. But anyway, then I think I did the most important thing that I can ever do, and that's to say, God, please help me say what you want me to say to these people. God is very much a part of my life tonight, you guys, and it did not used to be that way for me, I can guarantee you. I come from an alcoholic hell that I cannot even describe. It was so bad. And, you know, my life is real good today, and sometimes I forget how bad it was. And I can tell you that the day I got sober, I weighed 95 pounds. I was the color of squash. I had an alcoholic hepatitis. I had liver cirrhosis. I had ruptured esophageal varices. And if you don't know what that stuff is, you don't want to know what it is, because you die from that kind of stuff. And I was standing on Skid Row in Lincoln, Nebraska, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And if you guys haven't drank Mad Dog, I need to tell you, it's not one of your finer wines, I can tell you that. I can tell you something else, too. That crap has never seen a grape, I can assure you. And I literally could not believe what was going on in my life. And I'd lost my children. I'd lost my husband twice, although I didn't really care about that, I want you to know. I'd lost my car. I'd lost my house. I'd destroyed every relationship I'd ever had with anybody in my life. And I was clearly dying from alcoholism. And, you know, one more time tonight, this is not a game that I'm playing up here. This is serious business, and people do indeed die from alcoholism. And you guys, you know, it didn't start out my life being like that for me. I come from a lovely, lovely home, and I want you to know that, and my mother wanted you to know it too. I can guarantee you that. I was supposed to speak here 2 weeks ago on Wednesday night, and my mother died 2 weeks ago, you guys, and died suddenly, and I had to go back to Nebraska for her funeral and stuff. And, you know, as I stand here tonight, I am so grateful for what my sponsor has taught me, to be current with my family. And everything that needed to be said had been said a long time ago between my mother and I. And, like they say in AA, I was current with my mother, and that's the bottom line for me. And besides that, I know tonight that she's in a better place. I do know that. But anyway, I adored that woman. I shall miss her terribly and stuff. And she was always so proud that her daughter was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to tell you, although she knew nothing about this program. My dad died from alcoholism on the streets of Chicago in 1979, and you tell me how a major in the Air Force dies on Skid Row. I don't know how that happened, other than the fact that he was an alcoholic. And whether or not he ever found AA or not, I do not know. I just know that he certainly did not stay sober as a result of it. And, you know, one more time, this is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease that kills people. And I have a sister who was Miss Rah-Rah in high school, and she was homecoming queen and cheerleader and all that kind of crap, and made straight A's and never cracked a book, and I made straight F's and never cracked a book, and that was the difference. My sister was a beautiful little girl. She's a gorgeous woman today. She looks nothing like I do, I got to tell you. And she was a model for many, many years for Neiman Marcus in Dallas, Texas, and just retired here recently. Now she's teaching school in the West Indies. And I got to tell you that as a direct result of this program, I love my sister very, very much today, and I recently found out something about her. She's also very beautiful on the inside, too, and I never used to know that. I have a brother who's a pilot in the Navy in Spain who just got home from Operation Desert Storm, who was in that first attack over there, and I am so grateful that that war is over with. You have no idea. Neither one of these people are alcoholic. I have another sister who's married to the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, who got me out of one hell of a bunch of trouble when I got sober, and I'm welcome in their homes today, and I never used to be. I come from basically a very boring family, if you want to know the truth. They're highly successful people, and they bore me to tears, I got to tell you. I have a couple kids who are 32 and 33 years old, and I know I certainly don't look old enough to have kids that age, but by God, I am. And this is where it really starts getting interesting for me. These kids are anything but boring, I got to tell you guys. As a matter of fact, they're a couple of jerks, if you want to know the truth. I love my kids very, very much. Please don't get me wrong, but they are indeed a couple of jerks. And my eldest son's an alcoholic. He's in Nebraska right now, just beating the hell out of this disease, and just got picked up about 3 months ago for his number 9th drunk driving charge, and one more time he's gotten out of it. It never ceases to amaze me the crap that we get away with, and I know I'm the last person in the world that can help this kid. I can just be an example to him and keep my mouth shut, and that's what I try and do. I have another son who's not an alcoholic, he's not a drug addict, anything like that. He's just goofy is what he is. And I love to tell this story because it shows you exactly how my life goes. I got the strangest phone call from this son of mine about 6 years ago here in L.A., and he said, "Mom, I'm getting married tomorrow." And I said, "Getting married tomorrow?" It was a surprise to me that anybody would even have him, if you want to know the truth. And I said, "Jeff, why do you call me the day before the wedding and expect me to be back in Nebraska?" I said, "The Pope's in L.A. Identify and get a flight out of here." And he said, "Mom, I don't expect you to come. It's just going to be a tiny little wedding. Don't worry about coming." Well, you know, you don't tell people like me that stuff. I wanted to be there. And I was right about that. I couldn't get a flight out of L.A., and I was just in a twit. You have no idea. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and this is the kind of loving direction I get from my AA sponsor. He said, "Well, what the hell are you going to do? Walk? If you can't go, you can't go. Now shut up about it. I don't want to hear another word about it." And I did. And I talked to my mom the day after the wedding, and I said, "Mom, how'd the wedding go?" And she said, "Well, it was very lovely, but who was that little girl with them?" And I said, "What little girl?" And she said, "Well, apparently Jeff's got a 4-year-old daughter that you don't know anything about, and I suggest you call your son and talk to him about it." And I need to tell you guys that I was more than happy to do that. Make no mistake about that. I called Nebraska, and I said, "Jeff, how'd the wedding go?" And he said, "Well, it was very nice, Mom." And I said, "Who is that little girl with you guys?" And he said, "Mom, that's my daughter." And I said, "Why didn't you tell me that I had a grandbaby?" I was so upset with him. Not because I had a grandbaby, because I didn't know about it. And he said, "Mom, I was afraid you'd get drunk." And I thought, get drunk? I wouldn't have gotten drunk over that. At least I don't think I would have. And I was on the first thing smoking out of Los Angeles, California, to get home and meet my little granddaughter. And I got to tell you guys that this child is the icing on the cake. She is the apple of my eye. Her name is Brandy, and doesn't that just figure? You know, I know. And she walked up to me at the airport, and she said, "Are you my grandma?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." And she said, "Well, you know, you're my favorite grandma." And see, that's what I want to hear. That's the stuff I strive for. And I said, "Brandy, why do you say that? You don't even know me." And she said, "Because you wear ribbons in your hair, and grandmas don't wear ribbons in their hair." And I thought, well, that's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but I'll take whatever I can get here. And I flew her out to California about 3 years ago to give me a cake at my number 7th AA birthday or our Saturday night meeting. And she flew out here from Nebraska by herself, and I thought she'd be terrified to be on that airplane by herself, but I was wrong about that. She got off that plane like she owned it after sitting in the cockpit with the pilot the whole trip, and I knew I was going to be in bad, bad trouble because this little girl never shuts her mouth for 2 minutes, and I'm not used to being around little kids, and they drive me crazy real quick. And I said, "Brandy, do you ever be quiet? You're giving me a headache." And she said, "Grandma, I have a lot to say, and if you don't like it, take some aspirin, you know." I think that we have a prospective member of AA on our hands there. I hope I'm wrong about that. I stood in Lincoln, Nebraska 2 years ago, and I looked at my second grandchild, a beautiful baby boy that was born to my son and his wife, and I can tell you guys that tears of gratitude rolled down my cheeks because I should not have been standing there. And I stood in Lincoln, Nebraska about 6 months ago, and I looked at my third grandbaby, another beautiful baby boy that was born to that alcoholic son of mine and his wife, and one more time the tears were rolling. Things with my family are very, very good today. It is only a direct result of this program, I can assure you, and it took a long time for it to happen. You guys, when I was growing up, I was a disruptive jerk is what I was. Always in trouble, always getting kicked out of classrooms. I hated discipline. I was very, very rebellious. And I literally hated people telling me what to do. And I like it even less today, if you want to know the truth. And, you know, I never felt like I belonged anywhere. And I hear that a lot from AA podiums, and I'm right on with that 125%, I got to tell you. You know, I really don't remember my first drink, you guys, but I can tell you that I hope to God I never forget my last one. And I hope it was my last one. But I remember what alcohol did for me from the very beginning. It made me feel like I belonged, and I could be anything I wanted to be. I could do anything I wanted to do, and I drank at any given opportunity after that, and I was probably about 13 years old. You know, I realize that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and I honor that. I identify myself as an alcoholic from this podium. I used a lot of drugs, too. I need to make that a small part of my story. My sponsor encourages me to do that. And, you know, when I was growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska, there wasn't a hell of a lot of drugs on the street. But I'll guarantee I found every single one of those drugs. And, you know, there's some marijuana and speed and stuff. And, you know, today if you get caught for possession of marijuana, you get a ticket, big deal. When I was growing up, you went to prison is what happened to you. And that didn't scare me. Nothing scared me. I did everything I wasn't supposed to be doing. And I'm one of these alcoholic females, and I hate to say this from an AA podium, but it's precisely the way that it was for me, that if you pat me on the head, my pants fall off is what happens to me. And I got myself into a lot of trouble when I was growing up. I absolutely love men. I love everything about them. You name it about it, and I love it about them. They've been the downfall of my existence my whole life, and they continue to be today, I'm sorry to say. And I particularly like sick men, and there's a room full of them here tonight, I can tell you. But, I'm getting to the age now where silver-haired men are becoming very attracted to me, which opens up a whole new ball game, I got to tell you. But, yeah. You know, the young ones are nice, but sooner or later you got to talk to them, and they ain't got nothing to say that I want to hear, I can tell you. But anyway, I got pregnant when I was 16 years old, and I had to get married. And as it must be, I married an alcoholic. Don't most alcoholic women? I go for colorful, exciting men that beat the hell out of you and all kinds of stuff. And he wasn't even a man, you guys. He was only 17 years old, and I was 16. I couldn't cook. I couldn't clean. I couldn't take care of a baby, nor did I want to take care of a baby. And before we knew it, we had two babies to take care of. And I quick found out what caused all that, and I put a halt to it, I can tell you that. And that caused me a lot of trouble throughout the years. And as it must be, I married an individual that refused to work, that drank on a daily basis, and used to come home and beat the hell out of me on a daily basis. And I had never seen a man hit a woman before in my life, you guys. I'll guarantee you one thing. If my dad would ever hit my mom, she would have knocked him from here to the moon, I got to tell you. And I grew to hate this guy very, very much, and I'm not blaming him for my disease. So please don't get me wrong. It's just part of my story, and I need to share it. And somebody in that family had to get a job. And I found a job as a nurse's aide at a hospital there in Nebraska. And for the first time in my life, I begin to respect and admire something, and it's called nursing. And I had that respect and admiration today, too, by the way. And, you know, little by little, day by day, I was falling in love with the nursing profession. And I made a plan to myself. I would love to go to school, and I would love to become a registered nurse. That's what I would love to do. You know, they say that alcoholics don't have willpower. And I'm here to tell you tonight from this podium that that is a bunch of crap. I have more willpower than 20 elephants. When I want to do well, I'm going to do well. I don't have any willpower as far as my disease goes, but when I want to do something, I'm going to do it. And I went back and I finished junior high. I finished high school. I went to college full-time for 4 years, and I worked full-time for 4 years. And at the age of 27 years old, I became a registered nurse. And if you think I'm proud to stand up here tonight and tell you that I got jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska, and they told me, you are a disgrace to your profession, you're a disgrace to nursing, you're a disgrace to medicine, and you are no longer working because we just jerked your nursing license. If you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly wrong. You guys, I love my profession, and I really, really mean that. And I would never do anything to jeopardize the people that I take care of, nor the people that I work with under ordinary circumstances. And what I have to tell you tonight is a story about how I threw it right down the toilet so I could drink. And that is total insanity. It's also called alcoholism, I guess. At the age of 27 years old, I went to work in an operating room there in Nebraska, and I had that job for 19 years. I love working in surgery. I love taking care of those patients. It's a colorful, exciting nursing position. And I drank and I ran around with medical people mostly. They were colorful, intense people. They worked hard and they played hard. And, you know, the incidence of alcoholism amongst the medical profession is tremendously high. And that ought to do a lot for your security level if you're going to have surgery next week. But it happens to be very, very true. And I grew to love these people very, very much. And they're so grateful that I'm sober that they can't see straight. And I'm talking about alcoholics. I don't know anything about social drinking. I drank, I ran around with alcoholics. And we do indeed die from this eventually, I got to tell you. And, you know, in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, this is my favorite part of the book. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hand, your dark past will be the greatest treasure that you possess. And I found that to be very, very true in my sobriety. And I've been taught by Clancy to tell the truth up here because it can literally divert death and misery for other people. And I was in I got a funny story to tell you guys. I was in Nashville, Tennessee not too long ago giving a talk. And you know how people come up to you afterwards and thank you and stuff. And one of the fine ladies of Nashville, Tennessee came up to me afterwards. And she says to me, "You're disgusting." And she wasn't kidding. She was very serious. And I said, "Excuse me." And she said it again. And I told her, I said, "Lady, from where I come from, being disgusting is a step up, I got to tell you." And she kept right on talking. She just would not leave this alone. And so finally I had to say to her, "Look, you know, I have a sponsor and you're not it. And if I'd wanted you to sponsor me, I'd have flown to Nashville, Tennessee and asked you." You know, but that was the end of it. You know, I hear some women get up this podium and I wonder if they ever drank, you guys. I really do. And, you know, I wonder if they didn't do all their drinking in one room and somebody didn't shoot it to them through the keyhole with an eyedropper. You know, I've been taught to tell the truth up here, and that's precisely what I intend to do tonight. And you know, if that offends anybody in here, I would never offend anybody in the program that saved my life, I got to tell you. But, you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says clearly that we're to tell in a general way what our drinking was like. And you're going to get the general idea real quick about what my drinking was like. We have a little town in Nebraska, and it's called Palmyra, Nebraska. And it's a town of about 200 people. And I've been at the horse races in Omaha one night with a couple nurses that I worked with. And, you know, at the age of 27 years old, I divorced this man. And I was fancy free to do whatever the hell I wanted to do. And I loved it, let me tell you. And the girls told me, they said, "Karen, the horse races have been over with for 3 hours. We're all drunk. Let's go back to Lincoln." And I said, "Well, run along." I'd met two guys from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And these guys wanted to take me to a party. And by God, I was going. You know, like I said, you pat me on the head and I'll follow you anywhere you want to go. And I really can't tell you much about these guys, nor the party that I was at. I just know that I woke up out of a blackout at 2 o'clock in the morning on Highway 2 by Palmyra, Nebraska. And I found out something very interesting about Palmyra that night, that they take a dim view of naked women walking on their highways. I found that out. And here I was walking down the highway, stark naked, my high heels, carrying my purse. And it was February in Nebraska. And, you know, it's a tad bit nippy out there in February in Nebraska to be doing that. And tonight I know why ducks' feathers freeze, I can tell you that. And of all the luck, the first person I ran into was a state pig. And, you know, in Nebraska, the cops travel by themselves. They don't have a partner. And out here in California, they're a little bit smarter than that. And this guy stopped his squad car, and he turned on his siren, and he rolled down his window, and he looked at me, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I thought, well, that's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard anybody say. It's quite obvious what I was doing. And he said, "Lady, you get in this squad car, and you sit down, and don't you touch me." And, you know, one thing about a person like myself, every time I'm in trouble, I'll do one thing more to make it worse every single time. And I looked at this cop, and I said, "I'm not getting in your squad car because you might try and rape me." And he said, "Lady, I wouldn't bet any money on it. You are absolutely disgusting is what you are." And I'm here to tell you guys that that made me madder than anything that was going on, to show you how sick I was. And he had to get a matron out from the Palmyra, Nebraska City Jail to come out there and get me. And that woman was not pleased, I'll guarantee you. They were very busy that night at that downtown jail. They did not have time for this foolishness. And I went downtown booked in that cop's raincoat. You know how cops keep raincoats in the trunks of their car for these occasions. And I went downtown booked for indecent exposure, for assault and battery, for kicking in his windshield, for hitting her, for hitting him, all the delightful little antics that we pull as practicing alcoholics. And I will never forget how humiliating it was to be in that courtroom the very next morning when my brother-in-law, the public defender in Lincoln, who did not know I was in that courtroom, came up to me. And he said, "Karen, have you lost your marbles or what? Why would you do something like this?" And you guys, I looked at my brother-in-law, and I was to say this to many, many people in my drinking career in many, many courtrooms. I said, "Oh, for Christ's sakes, Dennis, this could happen to anybody." You know, and we all know better than that, you know. But that's honest to God the way I thought. If you're going to drink, these things are going to happen occasionally, so what, you know. And that cost me about $3,000 to get out of that, and I just shirked it off like it was no big deal. But I did learn one thing from that event I want to share with you. Don't ever drink with men from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And that's all I ever learned, and I kept right on doing it. I will never forget what it felt like to wake up in the very hospital that I worked at in surgery. And one more time, I've been at the horse races. You know, for a number of years, I thought the horse races were my problem. It certainly was not my drinking. And I'm one of these alcoholic females with a big mouth when I drink. And I have a big mouth in sobriety, but I can tell you the pain as a teacher here is getting a lot better. And I'd smart off to some guy at that horse race track, and he belted me right in the teeth is what he did. And a plastic surgeon was standing over me putting 18 stitches in my mouth. And I'll never forget what this doctor said to me as long as I live. I'll never forget this. He said, Karen, we love you so much. What is wrong with you? You're such a good nurse and stuff. We think you're an alcoholic. Let's send you to a treatment center and get this drinking problem taken care of so you can get on with your life here. And you guys, I could not believe the audacity this man had that he would say that to me. And I said, just fix my lip and get the hell out of my face. I'll drink if I want to drink. And that's exactly what I did. And the drunk driving charges and the bad checks. My kids were in trouble. I never could marry these guys I was engaged to. I was engaged 8 times during that divorce from this man, and they kept dying from alcoholism. And I thought to myself, you know, I need to get married to my ex-husband again. That's what I need to do. The kids need their father, and besides that, I need to get even with him for all the things that he's done to me. And those are not very good reasons to get married. And I got to tell you, I'm certainly not proud of it as I stand up here tonight. And, you know, if anybody in this room is thinking about getting married to the same person twice, don't do it. You're going to be sorry. The only way I can describe it is it's like taking a bite out of the same turd twice, if you will. And I danced that man through 3 of the most miserable years of his life on the face of this earth. And I love to tell you this story I'm about ready to tell you. And my sponsor always tells me that is not funny and you should not be telling that from AA podiums. And I always say, okay, Clancy, I won't tell it anymore. And he said, no, go ahead and tell it. Let those people see how sick you really were. And I'm still sick and I still think it's funny and I'm telling the story. When I married this guy again, I told him, I said, if you ever hit me again, buddy, I'm going to kill you the next time you hit me. And he said, I'll never hit you again ever. And I said, you better see that you don't. And he lied is what he did. And he came home drunk one night, and I happened to be sober this night for some reason. I'll never know why, because I usually wasn't. And girls, you know what guys do when they come home drunk. They want to take you to bed and stuff. And, you know, if there's anything I can't stand, it's some drunk man mauling me when I'm sober. I will say that when the shoe's on the other foot, though, it's fine with me. And this guy came home and indicated that to me, and I said, you get your hands off me and leave me alone. I wanted nothing to do with him, period. And he broke my arm is what he did. And I'm here to tell you guys that I was pissed, make no mistake about that. As a matter of fact, I'm still pissed about it, if you want to know the truth. And I told him, I said, you go to sleep on that couch, and so help me God, when you wake up, you're going to wish you'd never been born. And he sat up for hours, you guys, with his eyes pried open. And as it must be, he finally passed out. And I started drinking martinis, and this is a classic example of what alcohol did for me. Alcohol told me what to do. I didn't tell it what to do. And I had about 8-10 martinis, and I was feeling no pain, I got to tell you. And I was sitting there watching this guy. And I hate to tell you what this man was doing, but I can't tell you the story unless I tell you what he was doing. He was laying on the couch playing with himself. And I thought, you disgusting man, you make me sick to my stomach. And the more I drank, the madder I got. And, you know, you guys, I'm a nurse, and I'm very familiar with male anatomy. And I'd be very familiar with male anatomy if I wasn't a nurse. But anyway, I thought to myself, what can I do to get even with this guy for all the things that he's done to me? And I came up with this brilliant idea in my drunken stupor. This was about 18 years ago, you guys, when superglue first came out. And superglue was powerful stuff, and you did not want to screw around with superglue. And I knew that this stuff worked very, very well because my kids were nailing in the house that wasn't moving. And I got that superglue out in my drunken stupor, and I read the directions on that superglue. And like I said, I was drunk, and I wasn't seeing very clearly. And what I thought those directions said were, if this hits human skin, you better get it off within 15 hours. Now, why would it say something stupid like that? What it said was, in fact, if this hits human skin, you better get it off within 5 minutes, is what it said. And I went over to this guy, and I poured super glue all over this guy's groin, and I mean everywhere. There was not one place on this man that did not have super glue, and I laughed about it, and I went to bed. And I did not mean to hurt this guy as bad as I did, and I swear to God that's true, but I woke up in the morning to screams of horror like you cannot even believe. And I'll tell you what happened to my ex-husband. He never had the advantage of being circumcised when he was born, and now he clearly was, I can tell you that. And I get so excited when I tell this story, Clancy, I could just do it all over again. But anyway, we had a telephone by our bed there in our bedroom there in Lincoln, and he called the police, and the cops were out in front of our home, and there's sirens going. There was an ambulance out there, and the neighbors were gawking out of their windows. And, you know, one thing you guys got to keep in mind, they don't see things like this happen in Nebraska. In California, it wouldn't surprise me one bit, but certainly not there. And the cops were laughing, which led me to believe the whole thing was funny. And they said, lady, are you crazy or what? Why would you do something like this? And you guys, I stood there and I said, what about my arm that he broke? It was always me, me, me. It was never about anything I did to anybody else. And they said, you're under arrest for assault and battery. And I said, you can't arrest wives in Nebraska for assault and battery against their husbands. I knew better than that. And 2 days later, when I got out of jail, I guess I didn't know better than that. And they took that man to the very hospital that I worked at in surgery, and he had to have surgery. And one more time, the whole operating room saw what Karen did. And it turned out to be a horrible, horrible thing. Those doctors there in Lincoln couldn't get that glue off. And they had to get two surgeons down from Creighton University Medical School in Omaha, Nebraska, to get that glue off. And, you know, there's a paper written about that at Creighton. And if anybody in this room's thinking about going to medical school there, you can read about it, you know. I'd always wanted a paper written about me, but not like this, I got to tell you. And I was sitting in that jail thinking to myself, I'm getting the hell out of this marriage, because when this guy comes home from the hospital, he's going to glue something of mine shut, and he would have, too, I got to tell you. And God only knows I couldn't have that happen, you know. But anyway, I divorced this man one more time, and I will tell you on the brighter side of things here tonight that Alcoholics Anonymous really does work, because we have an amends step in this program, and my sponsor made me get on an airplane and fly to Sacramento, California, and make amends to my ex-husband, where he currently lives with his new wife and stuff. And I tried to tell Clancy, I'm not sorry that I did that, therefore I don't have to make the amends. He said, I don't care whether you're sorry or not. Get on that airplane and do what I'm asking you to do, and maybe one of these days you will be sorry. And I don't need to tell anybody in this room tonight that that guy kind of backs up when he sees me, I got to tell you. But we were able to sit down and talk and stuff, and I made my amends there. And I can tell you guys that I walked away from that guy, and I was free of what I had done to him. I was free of being married to him twice. And I can tell you that the promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous started coming true in my life when I made those amends. So I know that this thing works. You just got to do it for it to work. At this time in my life, I got involved with the most bizarre man I have ever met before in my life. This guy told me he was in the mafia. Now, I don't think anybody in Nebraska is in the mafia, for Christ's sakes. And I was lying to him. He was lying to me. It was your typical alcoholic nightmare is what it was. I was drinking on a daily basis. I was starting to take Valium for severe tremors I was starting to have. And it was beginning to be no more fun to be doing it, I got to tell you guys. You know, I love the bars, and I love the men. I love the sex. I love the music. I love all the crap that goes on in there. I fit in there like a glove. And I particularly like what goes on after the bars close, if you want to know the truth. And, you know, drinking for me at one time was a fun, fun thing. But it turned into a nightmare that was so bad I can't even begin to tell you. And I cannot remember the fun. I have to remember the bad things it did for me. And that's what I try to do on a daily basis. But anyway, the day came for me that the hospital told me, they said, Karen, we have had all the crap we're going to take off of you. We cannot read about our nursing staff in the paper anymore. Glue in husbands, bad checks, drunk driving charges, all the stuff that you're doing. Everything that you do in Nebraska is in the paper, I'm sorry to say. And they knew my game, let me tell you. And they said, you're either going to a treatment center or you no longer have this job. And you guys, you know, you don't tell people like me that stuff. And I said, you and what army's going to make me go to a treatment center? And I walked out of a job that I loved more than anything in the whole world, and I cannot say that enough tonight. And I drank and I drank and I died 1,000 times over. I went to work at a nursing home there in Nebraska, and what I'm about ready to tell you guys is something I am not proud to discuss from any AA podium. It took me years in my sobriety before I would ever mention this. I found myself stealing drugs from that nursing home. I was stealing morphine and Demerol and cocaine and Valium and anything I could get my damn hands on. And if you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly mistaken. And I kept that job, and one day these people that ran that place came up to me and they said, Karen, what is wrong with you? You're just weird is what you are. You know, you're a good nurse and you take good care of the patients, but you're just strange. And I remember thinking to myself, you'd be strange too if you had 200 milligrams of Demerol on board. You'd be strange too. And I threw my narcotic keys at them and I walked out the door before they fired me. And I went to work at Bryan Memorial Hospital there in Lincoln. And you guys, it's a fine, fine hospital. And I was drunk on that interview and I got that nursing position. And I'm not talking about falling down drunk. I was just maintaining a certain level in my bloodstream that I would not shake and have those violent tremors. That is clearly desperation drinking. Our book describes it vividly. And I was in hot water up to my yin-yang, let me tell you. I had to drink. I had to take drugs. I had no more choice in any of it. You guys, you know, I'm a nurse and I've studied alcoholism. And I thought I knew all about it before I became one. And it shows me one more time tonight that self-knowledge does not mean one damn thing with this disease. It's action that counts. And that's the only reason I'm standing here 10 years sober, I got to tell you. I did not think my way into 10 years of sobriety. Clancy and the actions of this program got me here, and that's all that got me here. And thank God I know that tonight, let me tell you. But But anyway, I kept that job for 6 months doing the same things I was doing at that nursing home, justifying in my head, I don't mean to do this. I'm not a bad person. This is a temporary thing. But you see, you guys, I had to have those drugs. I had no more choice in any of it. And I got caught red-handed one day stealing some morphine from that hospital. And this has got to be the most humiliating day of my entire life. When they said, you give us your narcotic keys and you get out of this hospital and don't you ever walk back in here again. We're reporting this to the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska. That's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they should have done. My other two jobs should have done it too, as a matter of fact. And to make a long story short for me, I lost my nursing license. I threw the one thing that I loved more than anything in the whole world right down the toilet so I could drink. And like I said earlier, that is total insanity is what it is. And to make a long story even shorter for me here tonight, I wound up on the streets of Nebraska is what happened to me. And you guys, I spent 2 years on the streets, and I've traveled all over the Midwest. I've hitchhiked all over. I've prostituted myself. I've done anything I had to do to get that alcohol and drugs. And I'll guarantee you one thing, that I have seen and done things that no woman should ever see or do. And I'm still so sick in the head sometimes I think to myself, I wouldn't mind seeing some of them again, you know. And my sponsor assures me that I'm still a very ill person to be thinking that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've been in nut houses, I've been in jails, I've been in institutions, I've been in hospitals, I've been chained down, I've been strapped down. I can't think of a thing that did not happen to me out in those streets as a practicing female alcoholic. And I hated myself so bad I cannot begin to tell you guys. And 2 years went by for me, and there I was back there in Lincoln, standing on Skid Row, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And I certainly had better things intended for myself than to be doing that, I got to tell you. I will never forget that last day of my drinking as long as I live, and I hope to God it was the last day of my drinking. I apparently was so physically sick I just passed out on the streets is what happened to me. But before that happened, I remember thinking to myself, you know, 2 years ago, there was a Hilton Hotel adjacent to that Skid Row area, and I remember thinking to myself, 2 years ago, I used to stand on top of the Hilton Hotel and drink martinis with surgeons. What am I doing standing on Skid Row drinking with these people? And I rather imagine those people felt the same way when they arrived there. And like I said, I can't tell you much about it at all. And I woke up in an intensive care ward of the very hospital that I was born at, that I worked at for 19 years, and I can tell you guys clearly that the alcoholic hell for me started the day I got sober. You know, I'm not a very big person. I only weighed 95 pounds a day I got sober, and I was coming off a quart or whatever a day and 200 milligrams of Valium a day. And that is a lot of booze, and that is a lot of pills, and I had a lot of dying to do, I got to tell you. You know, they say that most alcohol withdrawal is over within 3 days, and maybe it is for some people. It certainly was not for me. It was going to be a long, long time before I was going to start feeling better. And I don't know how many people in this room tonight have been through withdrawal, but it is not a pleasant experience, I got to tell you. And I used to scream at those nurses and say, you get me some Librium, you get me some Valium, you get me something. This is absolutely inhumane that anybody should have to go through this kind of withdrawal. And I was laying there with tubes coming out of my belly. They were draining fluid off my liver. I had IVs going. And I just wanted to die is what I wanted to do. And obviously, I couldn't even do that right. But let me tell you what these nurses told me. They said, Karen, you need to feel every one of those tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. I went to a fine, fine facility. They knew exactly what they were doing with alcoholics. And they went on to tell me, furthermore, there's nothing wrong with your heart. It's not throwing any irregularities, and you need to feel every one of those tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. And I did not want to hear that, let me tell you. But let me tell you what these people did for me. And I'll tell you guys, I will be forever grateful for this as long as I am sober in our beautiful program. They got about 10 people from AA to come and sit with me. And these people never left me day or night for 30 solid days. I had somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous with me at all times. And I grew to love these people very, very much. And I'll tell you why. There was nobody in my life the day I got sober. And my family was not buying it. This one either, let me tell you. They've been through it too many times. They were not going to go through it again. My mother had to be hospitalized because of me and put on tranquilizers, and I have not forgotten that by a long shot as I stand up here tonight. I loved my mom very, very much, you guys. She did not deserve that, let me tell you. And so for the first time in a long time, people were back in my life again. And I grew to love these members of Alcoholics Anonymous very, very much. And they would sit with me by the hour, and they would say things to me like, Karen, just keep breathing. That's all you got to do is breathe. And I'd say, when is this withdrawal going to stop? And they said, when it's time, that's when it's going to stop. And that wasn't good enough for me. I wanted a date is what I want. And they were absolutely accurate about that. When it's time, it's time. And at 30 days of sobriety, I walked in that official treatment program at that hospital. I'm a product of a treatment center. I have no opinion on one way or the other, but apparently I went to a Gubin because all they talked about was AA there. And I walked into group therapy for the first time, and there was 14 men in that group, and they were all younger than I was and stuff, and they were in there for drunk driving charges and stuff like that. I couldn't relate to where these people were coming from. I had done those things years prior to my alcoholism. And this one guy looked at me and he said, "You think you're better than everybody else here, don't you?" And I looked at this guy and I made a comment to this man that I was to pay for a long, long time in that treatment center. I said, "Yeah, you asshole, and you can put your name at the top of the list." I was an inpatient 30-day program for 7 months, you guys. And that is a long time to be an inpatient 30-day program. And I completed that program, and I went to an outpatient program, and I went to an evening care program, and I went to an aftercare program. And I found myself a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I wasn't doing one thing the way that you teach people in AA to do it. I would tell the new people, "You don't need a sponsor, and you don't need to read the book. We do whatever the hell we want to do around here. This is an individual program." And needless to say, I was not real popular with the old-timers in Lincoln, Nebraska. You know, the old-timers in AA are so precious to me, you guys, as I stand up here tonight. But in 1982, I could have cared less one way or the other what these people thought. And, you know, you can pull your crap around here just for so long, and these old-timers are going to start nailing you, one right after the other. And thank God that's what happened to me. And this old guy with 29 years of sobriety grabbed me out of an AA meeting one day, and he said, "You stay away from the new people. How dare you tell the new people in AA they don't need to read the book and they don't need a sponsor?" He said, "You're like a typhoid Mary in AA. Everybody dies around you, but you're able to stay sober somehow." And he said, "You stay away from the new people." And he went on to tell me, he said, "There's going to be a man from California speaking in Kearney, Nebraska this weekend. His name is Clancy, and you're going to go up and hear this man speak, and you're going to ask this man if he will sponsor you. He is a master at dealing with jerks like you." And I'd heard all about Clancy, and I wanted nothing to do with him, period, because I knew I was going to be in bad, bad trouble. And I got to tell you that my fears have been justified 8,000 times over. I told this old-timer, "Who do you think you are that you're going to tell me who's going to be my sponsor in AA?" He said, "If you don't get in that car and go with us Saturday, I'm going to tell everybody in Lincoln how you stole money from an AA meeting. And I'll guarantee you, I paid that money back too, Johnny. I really did." And I got to tell you guys that I found myself in Kearney, Nebraska. And I can tell you that from a podium in Kearney, Nebraska, that Clancy literally put the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous into my life. And my life has never been the same since that talk, and I'll tell you why. For the first time in my sobriety, I was identifying with another alcoholic. And as I understand Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what this thing is all about. I knew what was wrong with me, and I knew what I needed to do about it. I know of no finer speaker in the world than my sponsor. I'm not saying that you need to believe that. It's only important that I believe that. And by the end of that talk, I wanted him for my sponsor. And I found myself walking up to this guy and asking him to sponsor me. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. I don't sponsor crazy people like you. And that's a lie anyway. He sponsors people crazier than I ever thought of being. But anyway, he sponsors Frank Jones, for Christ's sake. You know. But anyway, he told me, he said, "Karen, I don't like to sponsor people on long-distance basis, but I'm going to do this for you, because if I don't do it for you, you're probably going to go die somewhere." And he said, "I'm going to tell you something, little girl, and you better listen to me real good, because I'm going to say it one time and one time only. You're going to call me every day that I tell you not to call me every day. You are going to read that book. You're going to sponsor people. You're become an active, viable member of this program. You're not going to argue with me. You're not going to defend your actions to me. And you're going to do what I ask you to do. And if you don't want to do that, then get yourself a different sponsor." And then he went on to tell me, "And furthermore, you're going to do what these old-timers in Nebraska ask you to do." And I, you know, you guys, you want to talk about we stood at the turning point. This is the day that my recovery began in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said two words that I almost fell over when I said them. I said, "Yes, sir." And I'll guarantee you that I say it today, too. You know, respect's got to start for me somewhere. It might as well start with my sponsor in this program. And I went back to Lincoln. I became very, very active in AA in the right way. And I wound up by sponsoring a lot of women in that town. And I'm not bragging about that. It's not that much fun to sponsor all these crazy women in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I grew to love these women very, very much. And I'll tell you why. They literally showed me the first 4 years of my sobriety what to do and what not to do in this program. Every one of those women are still sober today. It's not because of me. It's because they're active, viable members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, one of the first directions Clancy gave me, "I want you to get that nursing license back." And I tried to tell this man, "I cannot go through that kind of humiliation." And he said, "Karen, are you arguing with me?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Get up to the State Board of Nursing, Nebraska. You tell those people that you have been sober in AA for 2 years that you would like the opportunity to get your nursing license back." And you guys, I knew it wasn't going to work, but I did it anyway. And that's the most important thing I can say from this podium tonight. I did what my sponsor asked me to do, whether I thought it would work or not. And I went up there and asked him for my license back. And they looked at me like I had just grown horns on the top of my head, I got to tell you. And they said, "How many links are you willing to go to?" And I had to do a lot, you guys. I had to take crap off people for 2 years that I wouldn't hire to mow my own lawn, if you want to know the truth. And I had to keep my mouth shut in the process. And I got to tell you that one of the happiest days of my life happened about 7 years ago, when one more time I was jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing, Nebraska, and what they told me literally brought me to my knees for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. What they said to me was, welcome home. You're fully reinstated as a registered nurse. And I can tell you guys that that is a gift from AA. I do not deserve that. But let me tell you, I intend to take it. I can tell you that. And, you know, I came out here to visit a couple times. I fell in love with Southern California AA. If you're new in this room tonight, I want you to know that you are in the mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous in the whole world. This is the best place to be and be sober. And I know that's true because I get the honor of speaking in an awful lot of places. And we're so lucky to have this group, let me tell you. And I told Clancy on the phone one day, I want to move to Southern California. I want to belong to the Pacific Group. I want to work at UCLA in the operating room. I want this, I want that. And you guys, every single one of those things have come true for me. And those are all gifts from AA. I love this program so intensely, I cannot begin to tell you. And people say to me all the time, Karen, why do you keep doing it? Why do you keep doing it? And I know of no greater thing to say to them, so that this to the end, that my great blessings may never spoil me, that I may forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. And there's more reasons than that for me, you guys. You're the ones that walked with me when nobody else would walk with me. You held my hand when nobody else would hold my hand. And you told me that you loved me. And I need you as desperately tonight as I needed you in 1982. You've taught me how to live. You've taught me how to love. You've taught me how to keep my pants up and all those things. And I don't do any of those things very well. But I'll tell you the one thing that I do with 200% absolute perfection, and that is this, that I love you more than anything in the whole world. And it's truly a story from an alcoholic hell that I cannot even describe. I have truly been given, just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, I have truly been given the keys to the kingdom. And I'm going to say one more thing, and I'm going to sit down here. Clancy, it has been one hell of a walk from Skid Row in Nebraska to where I stand tonight in front of my home group in Los Angeles, California. And I think that but for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed it all. Thank you for having me, and thank you for my life.